been hit by a sharp aftershock, but there are no reports of injury or damage. The 5.2 magnitude quake struck at about 2:45 this afternoon. GeoNet says it was centred 10 kilometres east of the city at a depth of 11 kilometres. The Canterbury Earthquake Recovery Authority says it's cleared the red zone of workers for the day, but nothing fell down and no one was in the area was hurt. The New Brighton Library has been declared safe after being briefly evacuated while it was checked for damage. However, the temporary Linwood Library has been closed for the day and people are still being kept out of the Littleton Library. On Twitter, people have reported feeling the tremor in Timaru and Dunedin. One Christchurch resident tweeted there are no words that adequately explain just how damaging to sanity these quakes are. The lawyer for the captain of the Rena says it became clear quite soon that an attempt made by his client to cover up mistakes after the ship ran aground was futile. Both the captain and navigation officer, whose names are suppressed, are being sentenced in the district court in Tauranga today. They're both charged with willfully attempting to pervert the course of justice, operating a ship in a way which caused unnecessary danger or risk, and discharging harmful contaminants into a marine area. The captain has already admitted to altering the ship's documents, its original passage plan, and GPS logbook. His lawyer, Paul Mabey QC, says they would have been very difficult circumstances that led to the decision to make alterations. He also told the court the container ship's owner is spending $10 million a month on the salvage operation. The Prime Minister John Key is defending the government's decision to rush legislation through under urgency, which will result in more elderly people paying for their residential care. Under the change, the asset threshold, at which people have to start paying for aged care, will rise by the rate of inflation rather than by $10,000 a year as it does today. The Ministry of Health estimates 170 people will be affected in the first year and 610 by 2015-16. Opposition parties say the move was not publicised and the government has snuck it through without the legislation being tested at select committee. Mr Key says the changes were signalled in budget documents and it's the right thing to do in the long term. The Child Poverty Action Group says yesterday's budget makes children below the poverty line invisible and does very little to improve their prospects. Early childhood education gets more money for Māori and Pacifica children, and after-hours healthcare is cheaper for the poorest children. But social agencies at the group's annual post-budget breakfast say poor economic growth is not encouraging job creation, and early childhood education costs look set to rise. The childcare and housekeeper tax credit and tax refunds for after-school jobs have also been axed. The group's convener, Mike O'Brien, says the budget is littered with lost opportunities.
Children become very neglected, and as one of the commentators said this morning, in fact, within that it's Māori children, it's Pacific children, it's children with disabilities that are particularly singled out in that context.
Mike O'Brien says the 2010 tax cuts need to be revisited to redistribute that wealth to people who really need it. The police have changed their alcohol policy for armed offenders squad members to zero consumption within 12 hours of starting work. An inquiry has found that 14 members of the squad of about 60 that responded to a call-out last year, resulting in a fatal shooting, had drunk alcohol in the 24 hours before the incident. Nick Butcher reports.
Last year's incident at Opunaki in Taranaki was sparked by Anthony Ratahi taking his former girlfriend hostage. Mr. Ratahi was shot and killed by police, and an investigation found the shooting was lawful. The Police Assistant Commissioner of Operations, Nick Perry, says the officer who fired the fatal shot had not been drinking. He says most of the officers who had consumed alcohol were involved in a police inner security cordon only. And Mr. Perry says the officers felt they should be involved due to the critical nature of the incident. This is Nick Butcher.
The jury hearing the High Court case against the former Zimbabwean vet George Gwaze for sexual violation and murder is considering its verdict. Mr. Gwaze denies the charges which were laid after his adopted daughter Charlene Makaza died in 2007. In its closing address, his defence team said evidence from expert witnesses proved the 10-year-old, who had HIV, died of septic shock from an unidentified pathogen. But Crown prosecutors said she'd suffered blunt force trauma and that George Gwaze had suffocated the girl while violating her. And that's the news. You'll
say either, and I say either. You say neither, I say neither.
Hi, Lynn Freeman here, and on the Arts on Sunday, is there such a thing as a definitive movie review? Simon Morris and guest critic Dan Slevin prove that the so-called experts disagree as much as the rest of us. An orchestra meets hip-hop, Clash of the Titans, or A Marriage Made in Heaven. And theatre reviews are under attack. Does this mean the end of a national record of this important art form? The Arts on Sunday from 12:30 on Radio New Zealand International.
Now the forecast from Met Service to midnight Saturday. Northland mainly fine. Auckland to Manawa too, including the central high country. A few showers today, mainly fine tomorrow. Coromandel and Bay of Plenty, fine today, patchy drizzle tomorrow. Gisborne to Wellington and Whakapiti, showers spread north today, clearing south of Hawke's Bay by evening and elsewhere overnight, mainly fine tomorrow. Nelson and Marlborough, mostly fine, showers about the Kaikoura coast this afternoon, drizzle about Nelson and the Sounds tomorrow evening. Canterbury, patchy rain clearing this afternoon, remaining cloudy about the coast till morning, otherwise fine. Otago and Southland, mainly fine, rain about the lakes and western Southland tomorrow evening. Buller to Fiordland, fine today, apart from a few showers from Hokitika north. Drizzle tomorrow, turning to rain in Westland and Fiordland in the evening, becoming heavy overnight. And for the Chathams, rain this afternoon, then mainly fine. Now the Met Service forecast for the mountains up till midnight on Saturday. In the North Island, from the Raukumura to Kaimanawa and Kaweka ranges, showers clearing overnight, then mainly fine. Remaining areas, mainly fine, a few showers clear this evening, late drizzle about Mount Taranaki tomorrow. The wind strong sou'westers easing tonight, northerlies tomorrow, strengthening in the south at night. The freezing level, 2,800 metres, lowering to 2,400 tonight, then rising to 3,000 tomorrow. In the South Island, for the Kaikoura Ranges, fine, areas of cloud clearing this evening. Kahurangi National Park to Arthur's Pass, mainly fine. Scattered showers in the north clearing overnight, cloud increasing and drizzle tomorrow. The main divide south of Arthur's Pass, mainly fine today, drizzle in the morning, turning to rain tomorrow evening with some heavy and possibly thundery falls. The winds westerlies turning northerly tomorrow, rising to severe gale in exposed places. The freezing level 2,400 metres in the north, sloping to 1,500 in the south, rising to 2,800 everywhere tomorrow. I'll have headlines at 4:30, news and weather again in Checkpoint at 5.
The Kiwi Bank Young New Zealander of the Year from Christchurch's Student Volunteer Army, Sam Johnson, with us on the panel today. Good afternoon with Auckland critic and teacher Steve McCabe. Hello, Steve.
Good afternoon.
Now, you've brought something all wrapped up and mysterious looking. I'm not talking to you, Sam, I'm talking to Steve.
Yes, indeed. We've been busy this weekend, me and the missus. We've been looking at our beehive because it's getting close to winter and it's time to start closing the hive up. And so we've been plundering honey.
Oh, you have too?
Yes, indeed. We make the bees work hard and then we steal the honey from them. They call it robbing the hive for a reason.
Oh, it looks like good honey. You're not selling this commercially, I take it, or are you?
The hoops we'd have to jump through to sell it commercially, get it tested for tooting and get it labelled and all the rest. No, just, we just save it for our friends.
How many jars do you get?
You know, this year has been a real disappointment because we had that really, really rubbish summer.
Yeah.
They just weren't really giving us a whole lot of honey. And then we had that late burst of Indian summer, confused the queen. Something rotten. She thought it was spring all over again. Started laying more eggs, and suddenly the hive's full of eggs instead of being full of honey. And, I mean, frankly, these bees just don't know what they're doing.
No.
Really, somebody needs to have a word with them.
They need a talking to.
Exactly. But we only got... this makes great radio, doesn't it? Here, take a look at this jar.
Yeah, that's lovely. Hey,
fantastic.
Yeah, let me suck it on my finger. I'll just put
it
my
tastes
finger
great.
In
yeah, yeah,
exactly. Thanks very much. Fantastic radio. But that's about a quarter of a litre, would you say? And we've got maybe, five of those.
Okay.
This time round, not an awful lot at all from one hive. But first of all, we're not working the bees very hard. We don't really work our hive the way that commercial beekeepers would. We'll just let the bees get on with it, and if there happens to be any spare honey, then we'll snag it from them. But we're not really pushing them very hard. We're not making a living out of this. We're doing it for fun, really. And also, with the weather being what it is, I don't think we got the optimal honey flow this year.
All right. It's a good hobby, though. And do you get stung much?
Well... fantastically, when Debbie and I went out this time to harvest, neither of us got stung, and that's the first time since we've had the hive that we've actually managed to do a complete hive visit without a single sting. Last one I got was on the foot, and it's swelled up. That'll do nicely, thank you. There's a reason why I'm not an English teacher anymore. But it got big, and I couldn't walk for about 3 days. I was hobbling really badly from the swelling, from the sting. I seem to be developing an allergy.
Have you developed a different way of speaking? You know the accusation that beekeepers talk differently from other people? They develop a bit of a buzz?
Ba-dum-ching. Thank you very much,
I think it originated from a Roald Dahl story.
Is that right?
But you often hear people allege it in the community. I don't think it applies to you.
No, I think we simply talk as though it is a bit more superior to other people, sir.
Very good. The beekeeper is with us. Sam, very nice to have you back on. You've been busy. You've been in demand as a speaker as well, haven't you, lately?
Yeah, I've spoken at a few different events recently. Yesterday I was up in Auckland and got a wee bit of a feel, and they weren't screaming at me, but a wee bit of a feel of what the One Direction band must feel like. I walked onto a stage with some TV presenters, and 3,000 young people screamed. And it was just incredible, the passion and energy they had for this national young leader's leadership.
Where was the venue?
It was out in Manukau in the Big Waka building. Right. Okay, I don't actually know what it's called, sorry. But a bit of that, and then for World Vision as well, their leadership days around the country. And of course, tonight at 8 p.m. is the start, when 153,000 young people in New Zealand are starting the 40-hour famine.
Yes.
Which is just a great turnout. It's incredible.
Yeah, we know a bit about that in our house. All right, so that's the. So these are World Vision series of leadership days, are they?
Two different series. So one was the National Young Leadership Days, which happened across the country. I'm actually right across the world. They're incredible. And I spoke a lot about our ideas and creativity and just being a bit crazy when we're young. And when we are kids at school, we do things because we don't know what the consequences, and the importance of keeping on to that and realising that people are just people, and that you can you say your opinion and use your voice and listen to other people and really be very successful.
It's become a bit cliched to talk about, you know, the role of social media as a force for good or ill, etc., etc. But in fact, social media were an important part of the Student Volunteer Army. So I guess you talk about that too.
Yeah, a little bit actually. It was certainly touch on that, and really for me, it's about creating the alternative to what is already on social media. So a lot of parties pop up all the time. It's like, well, you can actually use it for other things as well if you just get motivated in the right way and actually just look at how different your interactions are between your different groups of young people and how they work. And I also I got a great laugh actually from the audience yesterday when I said to them, old people don't understand how to use this technology. We've got to embrace it, and we've got to actually understand that most of the country doesn't know or care how to use it, but we can use it for a lot of social good if we put our minds in the right way.
Sam Johnson, now you're going to mention your latest initiative, I think, at halftime today, are you?
I am, yes. I am. I thought I would.
Exciting. With Steve McCabe on the panel.
And I would like to point out that when I walk into a classroom, I get young people screaming as well, but possibly for a different reason.
I'm sure not.
And then the volume doesn't decrease through the day. You should see him in the classroom, Sam. So Sam and Steve, and the lawyer for the captain of the grounded container ship, Rena, has begun submissions in his client's defence in the Tauranga District Court. This has gone on all day, and both the captain and navigation officer, whose names are suppressed, are being sentenced. It's the big day today, as you probably know. They are charged with willfully attempting to pervert the course of justice, operating a ship in a way which caused unnecessary danger or risk, discharging harmful contaminants into a marine area. Graham Butler will join us shortly, but panel, it's an odd situation. The summary of facts only now becoming available because of problems with multiple languages, apparently. But the picture it paints is of what the Crown lawyer is talking about, as describes as fundamental incompetence. What is an appropriate sentence for that kind of behaviour?
It's so difficult, isn't it? I mean, I looked at it and I actually thought, is it incompetence? Or actually, on a broader picture, are we just becoming a bit complacent with our jobs? These guys obviously didn't know what they were doing enough, but they obviously assumed that they did and assumed you can cut these corners and get away with it. And I wonder if that's a sort of a bigger issue actually around the whole industry.
I've spoken to boaties about this, private sailors, and they're gobsmacked that this could even happen. You've got charts that have got things like this huge, great big reef, very, very clearly marked, And from what I've been told, there is no excuse whatsoever for driving your boat straight into it. These guys, I mean, it's clearly, at the very least, it's incompetence. One thing that sounds really, really unfortunate in all of this is that they actually pleaded guilty. Because that means we've got no trial, we've got no real opportunity for a public investigation of what actually led up to the incident, what caused them to do it. Were they being lazy? Are they relying too much on computers and simply saying, oh, what the hell, we'll just push a button and let the computer take us where we're going? Was there pressure from the shipping line? Are Costa Mare in some way liable? Was there pressure, take the quickest route you possibly can? We won't get these questions answered now, presumably, because there's no trial.
Although, yes, that's right. Although I notice people are talking about it. I mean, it seems to be in the common language, even if, you know, it hasn't come out in court. The captain believed the Echo that appeared on the radar directly in front of the Rena was a small vessel or a false return, an answer to part of your question. Graham Butler, Tauranga Charter skipper, owner of Butler's Swim with Dolphins, joining the panel today. Graham, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good to talk with you again. We wonder about the level of public interest all this time since, but there'll be a high level of interest, I imagine, Graham, today in the sentencing of these two.
Oh, yes, I think so. Yes, I think there's massive public interest. From what I understand, the courthouse is packed.
Has life returned to normal? This is the other thing the media does, isn't it? It swarms into the area, gives us a picture of the disaster, and then it's no longer newsworthy, and so we don't hear much. Have the ill effects of the pollution stopped? Do you have ongoing problems with the wreck? Does it still leak a bit of oil? What is happening there now?
I don't think that there's a lot of oil left on the wreck at all. Certainly the potential for any oil spill, oil hazard, is gone. Nothing at all can occur now on the scale of the first couple of days. So that's a good thing. There's lots of debris that are floating around in the beaches. One of the problems they've got that I've heard is lots of little plastic balls that are, you know, tiny microscopic things. Apparently there was lots of those in containers and they're floating around the beaches.
And they're still there.
Causing problems, yes, and there was a bit of a clean-up recently as well, and it's just ongoing clean-up. I think they've taken 800, or a little more than 800 containers off the vessel out of the 1,380-odd that were there. But there's lots of debris all over the seabed, and it's just... it's absolute chaos, really, that should happen.
How long-term an impact are you guessing, Graham, and what about your own business?
Well, I think the impact of the Rena will be, like, socially very long term, because I don't think people will forget about it at all, actually. In terms of the wildlife, we've been sailing a few days, even though it's midwinter, we've been sailing a few days out there, and we've seen pods of 200 or 300 dolphins and quite a few seals back in the area, seals on the rocks at Motiti Island. There doesn't seem to be any real oil contamination on the rocks at Motiti now. I was a bit sceptical in the beginning that the recovery would be as quick as some of the scientists said that it would be. But I have to say that I'm surprised, really. We also saw lots of diving petrels, like clouds of them, coming home from Mare Island a couple of days ago, and that was good.
Are people coming back, though, to swim with dolphins?
We're getting a bit of inquiry, but no, this is not the people's season anyway.
No.
But it was an absolutely disastrous summer in terms of people-wise.
How have you survived without collapsing financially?
Well, financially, it was a disaster. Financially for us, it was just, you know, you just have to draw a breath and hope that we can get through it and fire the business up again and carry on. We're hoping we would have to have a better year this coming year, but every summer since I started, we've done better business, and this is the first time this one has put us right back to, you know, we just didn't get the business. We had the Rena, and we had bad weather, and just the people didn't come to town.
Yeah, we've had the restorative justice session at Motiti Island, at which much appears to have been forgiven. Judging by the news today, I'm trying not to make you speak for the whole community, but what do you think the mood is now? Is forgiveness evident, Graham?
Well, I think from what I read that only three people at the meeting at Motiti Island sort of didn't forgive the master and the chief mate of the arena. I feel very sad for these guys. I sail quite often on ships, and I have done for the last few years, and most of the crews are Filipino, and I've sailed on several ships with Filipino master and chief engineer, chief officers. And I sort of take a bit of issue over the feeling that there was just, you know, incompetence, and there's a lot of people floating around out there that are just incompetent, and that's not the experience that I have. And I think that all of the Filipino crews and with Filipino captains and Filipino chief mates and officers, they've run their ship very well and very efficiently. So,
well, if I may ask then, I think you're probably onto something there, that maybe there wasn't absolute incompetence on the part of the master and the navigation officer. Could liability and culpability lie further up the chain? Could it be with the shipping company?
No, I don't think it would be with the shipping company. I think the responsibility, I've always believed that the responsibility is totally vested in the master and the chief officer that were on the bridge at the time. And it's patently obvious that they went away from the course that they'd drawn on the chart and headed towards Mount Maunganui. They made a slight port hand correction, and that was done deliberately. Somebody I heard mentioned that this was the Astrolabe Reef is a great big reef. It's not. It's a tiny reef. It pokes out. It comes up quite steeply. And if they had made this alteration, as I suspect they did, 75 metres north or south of the course that they'd drawn on the chart, they would have missed the reef entirely.
Yeah.
And what they did, I think, was not necessarily incompetent, but very stupid.
Yes, you've got an intermittent echo appearing on the vessel's radar, have you not? And and at the proverbial end of the day, what they did was increase the revs instead.
I didn't know that they increased the revs. I thought, I haven't read that. I don't think they decreased the revs.
The court heard today, apparently, from a Crown lawyer, that the captain called for the ship's engine room to increase revs. That's just a little point I noticed from the day's proceedings.
I wonder whether there was any connection between that order to the engine room and the sighting of the intermittent echo.
It doesn't seem so from the summary of facts, but that's all I'm working off, so I can't tell you.
Yeah, from what I heard, that they picked up the echo from 2.8 nautical miles away, and it was intermittent, and they thought that it may have been a small vessel, and they by the time they'd checked it out, that was just too late. They were going at 17.5 knots, and by the time the master apparently walked from the bridge, or walked from the wing deck into the navigation station to plot the ship's position, and that's when they struck.
So you'd be one of the ones. I mean, are you hoping for a custodial sentence, Graham Butler? I mean, what's your attitude towards that now?
I know. Well, it's really difficult for me because I sort of take the view that there but by the grace of God go I, in a way. As a mariner, and I've been a mariner for 40 years, and it's very hard for me to point the finger. I think that it's really, really difficult. I actually think that those guys, they've been here in custody. They've been deprived by New Zealand immigration of visits from their wives, and so their wives are not given visas to come and support them. Filipino people, even though they spend a lot of time at sea, they're very family-oriented, and most of what they earn goes back to their families. And that would be a big blow. And I have a lot of difficulty. I don't actually... I realise that they've caused a massive, massive impact to our local community and the local waters.
Graham, what's the feeling around the community about the sentence? Do people want them to be sort of have a custodial sentence, or is it people not too phased? They just want to send them back on their way.
No, I haven't heard too many people say that they should be put in jail now or anything. I haven't heard that so much.
No, they almost acknowledged their mistake by pleading guilty, haven't they, and realised
yes,
the
have.
Serious puddle-up.
Yeah, they have acknowledged their mistakes by pleading guilty, but then I recently got bowled off my bicycle by a woman who was going the wrong way, up a wrong-way service lane, came out over the footpath and bowled me over, and she was very apologetic too, but it didn't help me at all. Apologies, yeah. It's a very difficult, but I feel for those guys. I feel compassionately towards them, actually. I feel that they have completely stuffed up. They know they've stuffed up. They know that they're going to go back to the Philippines without work. It's most unlikely that they'll ever get work again in their chosen field. And they've risen up the ranks in the Merchant Navy pretty high. They're very competent people. They wouldn't have got to where they are without displaying a good level of competence.
Yeah. I think you've probably summed up the dilemma in a lot of people's minds, Graham Butler. Well, we will see, as they say. And thank you for joining us today.
That's okay.
Graham Butler, Butler's Swim with Dolphins, 26 minutes past 4 o'clock. And Sam and Steve are on the panel. Now, Bill Rosenberg, the Council of Trade Unions economist, is saying that the government's austerity-light approach to this year's budget is not going to stimulate economic growth. He told a post-budget breakfast today that the government needs to maintain a level of spending rather than continue with cuts. He says with the risk of another recession looming, more investment ideas are needed, not austerity budgets. Everyone talks about the need for growth ideas. Before we get your own, here's what Brian Easton said on the panel this week when we were talking about growth.
Growth goes onto the public agenda in the early 60s. And I can tell you that if you look at it carefully, there's not an iota of evidence that we've been able to accelerate the rate of growth since the 1960s. And I have to say, I don't think that's a peculiarity of New Zealand. I don't think, in truth, economists know much about how to accelerate the growth rate. We know how to maintain it at roughly the same rate as the rest of the world. But there's no evidence that the government has accelerated the rate of growth in the last 50 years.
Brian Easton on the panel on Wednesday, I think. Okay, so now that you've heard something of the claims for what the budget, you know, is going to achieve and the counterclaims that it'll send more New Zealanders to the airports and off to Aussie, did you find in any of the utterances a sign of any railway tracks leading out of the tunnel? What did you think?
Not really a whole lot, really, to be perfectly honest. I mean, we've heard on this very show recently repeated opinions that austerity does not lead to growth. That's been a fairly, from what I can figure out, well-established opinion among many economists. And so we'll do more austerity. Not quite sure how that's going to work. I'd like to ask, you know, in Mr. Key's previous life as a business type person, is that how he ran his businesses? Was his idea of trying to grow a business simply working within a budget, or was he ever interested in borrowing money in order to finance future investment and projects?
Well, that's a rhetorical question, considering the Prime Minister isn't with us, and I don't think he's going to phone.
I'm very disappointed.
On the basis of your question. Well, we've heard this week, yeah, you're right, about how growth is often promised, it's often exhorted, it's often emphasised, and according to Brian, it's not delivered on that much. And you wonder why not. And is it because nobody has any clear idea about how to achieve it? Everybody has an opinion, or some people do. But the opinions, Sam, never seem to coalesce.
Yeah, no, it's such a difficult thing, and certainly the budget for me doesn't provide a much hope for our future past actually getting back into the surplus. I seriously worry about the legacy that we're leaving, particularly to children, from that budget. And I think relating back to the clip you just played before about growth, were in fact 10, 15 years ago, were the baby boomers just a little overconfident with the economic forecast? podcast. It's not something I'm well versed in, but I do think a lot of things in the budget have really just put big question marks through a lot of Generation Y in this country at the moment, who actually don't have time to protest and don't have time to get out and really show their opinions because they're so busy, because they're, I guess, to go back to Maslow's theory, really they're just surviving, they're just trying to get by, and this is a bit of another blow to them, which I was actually really upset about. So I think, you know, we've got some other work to do there, because we need to provide hope and we need to look at the legacy that we are leaving to our children in 20 years' time.
Let's talk about, thank you, Sam, let's talk about a specific of the budget. The budget's $5 increase in the price of 20 cigarettes.
Yeah.
Some wish the government had added a much bigger shock, you know, to its series of smaller rises. First of all, your opinion on hiking tobacco, before we make the tobacco and alcohol comparison, and people do say you raise the price of cigarettes and you deter people from buying them, and it seems to make sense. Other people look at Canada and found that when they hiked tobacco taxes there, they fueled the gang-controlled black market and contraband cigarettes. Do you think it's going to work?
Well, oddly enough, by way of show prep today, I crowdsourced some opinions from my kids at school. I thought I'd get, you know, a bit of suggestion. And that was one perspective that was coming out, that one of my students suggested that, yes, nicotine is a very, very powerful addiction. And a lot of people aren't simply going to say, oh, well, fair enough, I can't afford it, I just won't bother anymore. That's not going to happen. What you're going to get instead is either a black market, where people are going to desperately find a way to satiate their need, or we're going to get crime. People either will steal it for themselves, or they'll steal it and then sell it on for others. This is not something that is discretionary. You can't simply say, you know what, budget's a bit tight, I'll lay off the ciggies this week. That's not going to happen.
Well, I think you're probably right about the middle-aged cohort, you know, the 35 to 50-year-olds who may have more cash and they just, you know, grin and bear it. But it presumably will financially incapacitate young people.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
But like I say, when you're dealing not simply with something that you like, but something that you have made yourself need, then it's not going to be quite so easy just to shrug your shoulders and say, well, you know, spend it on something else.
Though I do see exactly what Tariana Turia was pointing at by saying, let's chuck up the price straight away right now. But I agree that, you can't, it's not going to break that addiction to it. But certainly over the longer period of time, we've got to really just stamp it out. And it seems to be working. And I was in Australia recently, and just look at the number of people down the street who smoke there compared to here. And like, we're doing well, and we're on the right track, I think. So I'm positive about the move.
All right. Okay, let's say it's a good move. If smoking is so wrong, though, if we should drag smokers into a healthy future where they don't sully society with their habit, let's agree that it's a good thing to do, then what are we doing about drinking? A lot of people are saying.
The government could really own this issue. They could really, the alcohol reform bill's coming through, but I think it hasn't gone far enough, and they could have done more about it in the budget, because it's a serious thing that's, I think, holding back our country with the amount we drink and the culture that we keep creating, and we actually feed. We're feeding this culture that it's and legitimizing a hangover, that it's actually okay to be drunk on a Sunday morning. And I'm on a side note, I'm actually doing the Hello Sunday Morning campaign at the moment, 3 months without drinking, just to sort of take a stand around this. And I think it's such an issue that we almost just it was completely ignored.
You could easily, yeah, well, no, it's an interesting thought. And you could easily, presumably, Steve, hire ad agencies to run a prolonged campaign that gave drinking a very bad look. You know, people would come out of nightclubs, they'd start fighting, they'd throw up in gutters, they'd beat their children, they'd abuse nurses and A&E, and you could make it look very bad.
No, you could, except that over millennia, alcohol has been given a fairly benevolent image in most Western cultures. It's part of our society, it's what we do. You could attempt to do that, and you might get some traction, but the bottom line is, drinking is a socially acceptable thing. It's got prestige, it's got class. There's something very, very glamorous about sitting with a, let's say, a glass of scotch in a nice crystal tumbler. You've got that's what I'll be doing this evening with any luck. You've got, you know, James Bond with his martini. You know, this is glamorous, this is prestigious. It's what refined and sophisticated people do. Ciggies are a bit dirty and a bit grubby and a bit smelly, aren't they?
But they didn't always used to be. James Bond probably lit up a Lucky Strike,
yeah,
and as he, you know, sipped martini.
Yeah. Oh, the post-coital cigarette was a standard part of most Sean Connery Bonds. But somehow, I think it's partly because the fact is it is impossible to smoke a cigarette without stinking for several hours afterwards. A glass of red wine is not going to turn your fingernails a nasty colour, and it's not going to make your breath stink for
but
a very long time
people didn't
afterwards.
Used to care about that so much. That was sophisticated. I guess what I'm saying to you is if alcohol is such a bad scourge on our society, you know, if it really costs us $5.4 billion a year, then you could actually address that in the way that they've targeted smoking.
Well, you could.
I totally agree, yeah. Though I think with it, with alcohol, it's something we look forward to as we grow up. You look forward to being able to drink alcohol and being able to party like we see our parents doing, like we see our sort of some in the middle, you know, whatever age people out there on the street. But then you actually, we need to shift it from that. That's not the biggest thing about turning 18 or turning 20 that you get to go and drink alcohol. We need to. It's a whole culture shift that needs to start, I think, within actually that sort of 30 to 50 age bracket.
I'd also suggest if we're going to do the advertising campaign, one thing not to do is the health warnings that the Japanese have on their cigarette packets. When I lived there, I used to see in my local train station a great big huge billboard over the railway lines advertising Marlboro cigarettes. And the caption underneath in Japanese is, "Tabago suisuganai yo ni chuu ishimashou," which basically translates to, "Let's be careful. Let's try to be careful not to smoke too much." Which is such a delicate way of wording it.
It's very polite, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
They're polite, yeah.
Sam Johnson, Steve McCabe on the panel. Back with them shortly and our complaints choir.